Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. George Bernard Shaw is our subject this morning. 1856 to 1950. So we have finally reached a playwright of this century who was alive at the same time as I. At least he died when I was a teenager. He was 94, so we're not exactly contemporaries. Many talented man, a critic, a reviewer. He wrote 5 novels. He was a historian, a lifetime political polemicist. He was a founder of the Fabians. He was a crusading socialist all his life. He was a great wit, a brilliant man, sometimes a buffoon, always an iconoclast. And above everything else, a dramatist. I never did get the final tally of his plays, but it was something well in excess of 30 major plays. A new adjective was coined to describe him and his characteristics, namely Shavian. And to call something Shavian is approximately to say that it is brilliant, witty, and acerbic. There's an edge to it. I had compiled at one point a whole list of these Shavian modes, which are delightful if you agree with him. And here's one which has nothing to do with our play, just to give you an idea of the quality of this man's ability to wisecrack. Quote, "Do not do unto others as you would that they should do unto you. Their tastes may not be the same." Now, Shaw's plays are chock full of memorable lines of this kind. So you're always in stitches, you're always laughing at simply the Shavian quality of them. And that in and of itself is sufficient to read one of his plays. They're on stage, the slightest and most disorganized of them are thoroughly enjoyable because of this quality. I read from Shaw himself now as to how he transformed the English theater. He began, of course, in the 1870s and 80s to produce plays. Quote, "When I began, the London stage was crowded with French dramatizations of police and divorce cases, spoiled by the translators in deference to British prudery." "Speeches of more than 20 words were considered impossible and too long. I knocked all that into a cocked hat by giving my characters religions, politics, professions, and human nature." And that is certainly true. This man became so famous around the world that in 1934 a letter was addressed to him, and on the front of the letter it said only, there was a sketchy caricature of him with this huge bushy beard that he had, and underneath it was the word "London" or wherever else he happens to be at the moment. And it got to him. Now, I picked St. Joan because although Shaw does not have a great sense of theatrical structure and does not tell a good story, generally speaking, this is the closest to a good plot structure that he has, and it also has many other virtues as a play. This opened actually in New York in 1923, but it's officially dated from its English opening in 1924, and it won the Nobel Prize in 1926. The story he tells in this play, according to my limited knowledge, is historically accurate, except for his glamorization of the Inquisition, which he knew himself is inaccurate, but he did it for a deliberate purpose, which we're going to discuss shortly. And the bare facts are that Joan was born in 1412, and she was burned at the age of 19 in 1431, which is just the last gasp of the Middle Ages. The verdict was actually reversed by the church 25 years later in 1456, even though she was burned, and she was then canonized 500 years later in 1920. So this was a very current subject in the 20s. that the church finally, after all these centuries and after having burned her at the stake, turned her into a saint. And it was the bitterness implicit in that that made him decide to do the play. It's a perfect subject for Shaw because Joan was a misunderstood rebel defying the world, and he regarded himself as being exactly that. And it's often said that this is his autobiography, spiritually speaking. St. Joan as George Bernard Shaw. The world didn't understand him either, and the final line of the play would certainly be something that he would feel intensely. How long, O Lord, how long? Now, Shaw was an unprecedented mixture among playwrights, intellectually speaking. He was a religious believer and a skeptic, even an atheist of sorts. He is a real cynic and a hero worshiper. He's a tragedian and a boisterous comic at the same time, in the same scene, and virtually in the same speech. So you're going to get a mixture here that will, you will either find rich or poor because of its constituent conflicting elements. One critic writes of St. Joan, it was not his last play, but the few later ones were not too important. It was a late play. Describes it as follows. This is a religious writer, so you'll understand the wording. Quote, his last major play, his last great tribute to human greatness, as such, that's the debatable words here, it is one of the supreme statements of religious faith in a post-Christian world. The final masterpiece of a man who was willing to hope and think and challenge his readers to the end. All right, let's plunge in with the plot theme, number two. And the first question we have to ask about this, to get anywhere with this play, is a question we never had to ask about any other play. Is this a period piece or not? A historical piece or not? Now, the fact that a piece is set in the past doesn't make it necessarily a historical piece. None of our pieces so far have been that. And the theme of St. Joan is obviously universal. It's not simply historical. It deals with the fate of genius in any age. But we are asking, in terms of the essential action, is it timeless or is the action necessarily located in a specific era? Now, I tried to say that even La Cid, which seems to be set in the feudal time, is timeless in its action, that the essential action could be laid in any era. You cannot, however, say that about this play. The very essence of the action, the struggle between Joan and an all-powerful church and aristocracy. Well, you could rewrite this as like Kira Arganova in Iran today. But it would lose its distinctiveness then. It would become any rebel against the environment. The way it's actually written, the action throughout depends on and essentially involves the medieval setting. The power of the church, the feudal gentry, the Franco-English war, the violent debate about miracles and voices, the emergence of Protestantism, the emergence of nationalism. Now, all of that stamps it inexorably as being placed historically. So as I say, there's still a universal theme in philosophy, but in its essential action, I regard it as a historical piece, and we must therefore approach and define the plot theme accordingly. Now, with that understood, we just plunge in at random. What is the action of this play? Well, a young country girl in the 15th century saves France from the English and is martyred for it. Now, that's basically a summary of the action. Be a little more specific. She leads, don't take this down yet, I'm just groping to get there. She leads the French army to victory in a war against the English invaders, and crowns a Dauphin. You know who the Dauphin is? like the king elect, and she crowns him at Rheims Cathedral. So she sets out to save France. That's good enough from the English. Now, what do we have to put to make this precise? Is it relevant that she's a teenage girl in the 15th century? Yes, I think it is. Her age is relevant to her utter innocence and to the fantastic nature of her feat. Even the naive Dr. Stockman of Enemy of the People was a mature scientist. And here, a teenage girl leading a medieval army is utterly fantastic. So how about if we just say for the plot theme, a teenage girl sets out to save medieval France from the English army. That sounds like a great setup right there. That is insufficient on what one major grounds? Well, yes, it leaves out her motivation, but we could say her motivation is implicitly patriotism. I hear that? Well, there's a conflict indicated in that statement, but it's the wrong conflict. The central conflict of this play is not French versus English. And if you were to say, she sets out to save France from the English army, and this is the essence of the play, you are implying that the French versus the English is the heart of the action of the play. And that is completely wrong. There are brief references in this play to the Franco-English conflict only as background or setting. You never see them fighting. And as a matter of fact, what you do see of their relations is a complete collaboration of the French and the English on all essentials. And is that an arm? You have to move your arm. Yes. Versus
world order.
Absolutely. The central conflict is Joan versus the church and the feudal nobility. Joan versus the medieval establishment. And that includes the English and the French, nobility and army and church. In other words, in the nature of her quest to save France, she's brought into conflict with the leadership of both countries. That is the core of the play and of the conflict. Now, note in contrast to Ibsen, another small contrast, Joan gets along famously with the common man. The masses adore her. So this is not Joan versus the mob. It's Joan and the common soldiers and people against, although they're not given a part in the play, against the establishment. So the situation is she sets out to save France and finds herself at war thereby with the church and the aristocracy of both countries alike. Now, the old word is thereby. By the very fact that she sets herself at war to save the French, she finds herself at war with them and with the English too. Now, let's start right at this point and understand, because this is the pivot and Shaw's brilliant idea for the play. What is the logical reason, developed clearly, in fact even too lengthily in the play, as to why her setting herself out to save the French brought her into conflict with church and nobles alike? What did she represent? What did her attempt to represent, to save France, represent to the establishment that made her a grave threat? What two emerging forces does Shaw have her symbolize? Protestantism and nationalism. Now, of course, Shaw understands that this is anachronistic. This is the century before Luther. And nationalism was just a gleam in somebody's eye. He knows that just as well as anybody else. But what he is trying to say is that the forces that subsequently, and not too late from now historically, the forces that subsequently became Protestantism and nationalism, and which devoted body blows to the Catholic Church and the feudal power structure, were implicit in Joan of Arc, and that we can see future history unfolding in what happened to her. That is Shaw's actual genius of an idea. Well, let's see first what the thread is, and then why it's implicit in her. Why, this is an obvious question, is Protestantism a threat to the supremacy of the Catholic Church? It's not just that it's another church that set up shop next door. Protestantism from protestation. Protestantism is individualism in regard to religion. Its founding thesis was the idea of the individual's own private communion with God, that man has access to divinity as an individual. He need not go through the authority of the church in order to find out God's message or in order to achieve salvation. Now, this is an obvious threat to the church because the whole church structure was based on the idea that they are the voices of God, the representatives on earth, and that you cannot get to God by bypassing the church hierarchy. But Joan claimed to get voices directly from God. She was in one-on-one communication with him. And of course, if that were possible, that is a body blow to the church. So, it's Protestantism in that way. Now, of course, Luther's famous theses were not nailed to the church in Wittenberg until what year? 1517, so that's about a century later. But you can see why Luther didn't spring like Zeus out of the ground whole and unborn. There were these preliminary stirrings, and it is not implausible to see Joan of Arc as one of the first embodiments of the individualism of the modern world that is going to take shape in the form of Protestantism later. Now, the same Protestant spirit threatened the nobility of the time. Why? It threatened the attitude of unquestioning obedience to the status into which you were born. It said, every man has his own pipeline to God, no matter how poor, or whether he was born on the land, in a feudal mansion. Doesn't make any difference what the church or what your Lord says. And therefore, this is a big threat to the ability to organize people into obedient social strata who would owe their allegiance temporally to a nobility. At the same time, now let us look at nationalism. Now, nationalism is a distinctively modern attitude, where it's not just a bunch of loose city-states, but a whole geographic territory becomes a powerfully united entity, and the various parts of it are merely its derivatives. The way Rhode Island is to United States, even if you're in Rhode Island, your primary allegiance and your life dominantly is to United States. And the whole history of the United States has been the weakening of the states and the power of the nation. Now, this was an obvious threat to the nobility, this emergence of nationalism, because the country as a whole becomes the major unit, not the local estate or province or district. And who rules the country? Well, according to Joan and according to later nationalist doctrine, the king is the ruler of the whole country, and he rules by divine rights. So he thereby becomes preeminent over all the lesser gentry and aristocracy. In the earlier Middle Ages, the kings were much weaker, and the local lord was master. And then the king was, as somebody put it, a traveling show who came through and you bowed to him and so on, but he didn't really have the power that he subsequently had under the nation state. So nationalism overrode these feudal estates, and so there was a great threat to the gentry at the time. Similarly, the emerging nationalism of the period fractured the Catholic Empire. What does Catholic, the word Catholic, actually mean? It means universal. It's the same word that was coined by Aristotle to stand for universal in the problem of universals in philosophy. Catalu, according to the whole. So the Catholic means the empire of Christendom, which is one totality ruled over by the church. And suddenly now you have emerging the French versus the England versus Holland, etc., which was a grave threat to the unbroken power of the church. So both establishments, the church and the feudal, that is the spiritual leadership and the temporal leadership, needed to be regarded as the only spokesman of God to whom the ordinary man had to pay obedience. And Joan comes in at this context and says, I heard from God directly. No pipeline from you is necessary. No middlemen are necessary. And he tells me, Mr. Bishop, that I know better than you what he wants. And he tells me, Mr. Noble, that I know who should rule, and it's somebody with a lot higher powers than you who's going to take in a whole vast territory. Now, as Warwick, the English noble, puts it, Joan represents the protest of the individual soul against the interference of priest or peer between the private man and his God. And the whole key to this is that Joan declares that her mission comes from God himself. That's the key to the individualism of the play. If she simply awoke with ambition to save France and then did so, and they interviewed her after and asked her, how come, you know, you were so successful? And she said, I took these Taekwondo lessons since I was a child. There never would have been a clash with the establishment. So essential to the plot theme is that Joan, the individual, hears voices from God, or at least thinks she does. So let's put it all together in the shortest sentence I can make. Now, you know, once you get these long plot themes, it already means there's going to be some problem with the play because there's too much in it. A young girl in the 15th century, comma, moved by, quote, voices from God, comma, close quote. As we're leaving open where those voices come from. Sets out to save France from the English army. Dash. This is a really good test. If you take more than 10 words, there's a problem somewhere. And finds herself at war thereby. Both with English and French. Or both with the English and French establishments, or with both the English and French establishments, however you want to word that. A young girl in the 15th century, moved by voices from God, sets out to save France from the English army and finds herself at war thereby with both the English and the French. Now you see that you cannot have just the second half. It couldn't be. The young girl finds herself at war with both the English and the French, because that per se is nothing. That's not a play. We want to know what is the cause of this. If she were at war with the English and the French, and they were against her, and she said, well, the reason was I just read Atlas Shrugged, and I have a terrific ideological disagreement with them, it's either no play or a completely different play. The whole essence of the play and Shaw's brilliance is the irony of the fact that she is committed to fighting against the very people she is intent on saving. The brilliant plot idea was her goal is to save the country, and that requires her to destroy its leadership and therefore, in their eyes, to destroy the country. Now, that is a good conflict. That's an original idea, a truly original idea with Shaw that I know of. All right, let us look now at plot structure. Now, it falls into three parts, but it is not the traditional, or I may say the proper, since I'm prepared to go on the line and hold out for the well-made play. It is not the traditional structure. It's not a well-made play, because he establishes the plot theme situation fully. That is, that she finds herself at war with the English and the French only by scene four, which is the very climactic scene, because it's the scene in which the English and the French make the pact to do away with her. They realize that she is the threat to both of them. And consequently, from that, there is no rise in intensity from the point of the establishment of the situation. There is a rise of sorts as she ascends the French establishment to the point where she leads them on the battlefield. But all of that rise is incidental to establishing the basic situation, and in the moment it's established, you know how it's coming out. As soon as you see that she's going to have to take on the establishment, in that moment you know that she's lost at the hands of the establishment, because you find it out as they swear a pact to destroy her, against which she has no power, obviously. And consequently, Shaw forfeits one of the crucial elements of structure, the rise to a climax from an established situation. Even so, I may say, it's still better structure than Shaw usually has. So, he just, having said this, let me tell you how he defines her structure, the structure of the play, I mean. He says it has three parts. It's a romance, followed by a tragedy, followed by a comedy. The romance is the happy rise and triumph. Joan gets her first start from Baudricourt. She reaches the court of the Dauphin and then reaches her height in the play. She's put in charge of the army at Orléans. And she has that nice scene with young Dunois. And by the way, strictly on the side, if you're a female in this course looking for a romantic partner, you should certainly consider him as one of the more attractive men in all of these plays. He's young, honest, able, courageous, good-looking, strong. It's not a major character, but you should certainly take him over Iago and a few others I could mention. In any event, there are three scenes to this romance. Each is essential. She has to penetrate the establishment. She has to rise to meet the king. And then she has to show her prowess on the battlefield. And I'd like you to note in passing that there is a comic, a pronounced, almost a raucous comic element throughout, which is the insignia of Shaw. It starts right off the bat. She performs a miracle, and it's a hilarious, a farcical miracle. The hens won't lay anymore. Then the cows stop giving milk. Now this element, and of course they laugh at it, this is so ludicrous. The whole idea of Shaw, or the whole style of Shaw, is the continuous injection of farce alongside of and seemingly directly integrated to the most serious or tragic or intellectual elements. So you have these farcical figures at court. And even in tragedies, even in the moments of tragedy, they're making wisecracks or doing the equivalent of intellectually slipping on a banana peel. Now, I'm going to comment on that later. You either find that a great asset or that rubs you the wrong way. So people love him or hate him, but it is certainly unique to him that I know of. You see, there's such thing as a serious play which has comedic elements like Enemy of the People. But this is a tragedy, an out-and-out devastating tragedy where the heroine is burned at the stake and there isn't even the hope of redemption in the future. And in the midst of that, it's slapstick all the way through. And that, if you knew only that much, it could only have been George Bernard Shaw that wrote it. So, what does that mean? Well, I'm going to give you a little taste of that. If I run out of time, maybe in the question period. Shaw himself was aware of this combination of feats. And I'll read you what he had to say about it, maybe in the question period. Anyway, after the romance comes the tragedy of her fall. And that's 4, 5, and 6. Scene 4 is the essential ideology of the play, the discussion of Protestantism and nationalism, and leading to the alliance between the church and the nobility, and including the French, the representative of the French Cochon, and the representatives of the English. So you can tell from that point that it's going to have to end tragically, even if you didn't know the history. And as, who is it, Stogumber puts it, it is expedient that one woman die for the people. Now, if they say that in scene 4, if the church and the nobility are the leader and the hope of the entire country and she's going to subvert all of them, then it is a case of one woman versus the people, and so to them it is self-evident that she just has to go. And since they have every variant of power, foreign and domestic, secular and transcendent, she has no hope of survival here. So the climax, as I say, comes in the very moment that you grasp the problem that she's going to have, which is a trouble with this play because it doesn't milk the excitement the way it would if only Shaw would discipline himself down, or maybe I shouldn't say down, if he disciplined himself to a more well-made play structure. Nevertheless, there is a lot of suspense because we don't know how she's going to be brought down, or rather, from history, you know that, but you don't know the form it's going to take in the play. And the excellent touch on Shaw's part, which preserves the suspense, is the sincere, or the honesty of Cochon, the French religious man, who is going to see that the Inquisition gives her a fair trial and sets himself up against railroading her. And this becomes, therefore, a powerful agent of suspense. Is he going to intervene and save her, or is he going to hold them to some standards of judicial rectitude that will prevent them from doing away with her? Scene 5 merely shows you that what happened to the English is the same thing as going to happen to the French. The French, we see, are moved by the same essential considerations ideologically as the English. She's just a pain in the neck and a threat to them. On top of that, they feel personal resentment at how well she's been doing. Every important person in the French side feels that she has showed them up. She's more attuned to God than the bishop. She's more in touch with the welfare of France than the king. She's better at battle than the army. So she's just sowing enmity wherever she goes because of her virtues. So her foes, the English, were united against her in 4. Her friends desert her for similar reasons in 5. She's completely doomed, and it's only a question of who is going to get her. The English want to seize her as a witch because she works miracles. The French want to seize her as a heretic because she refuses to obey the instructions of the church. Now, Shaw could have theoretically gone either way with this play, but historically, of course, she was captured by the church. And in actual fact, the English were more pragmatic. They didn't care who got her as long as she was dead. So they didn't have a big passion to avenge her. She was more a French woman and a French problem. The church, by the way, denied that she was a witch. Why? The French church. Well, a witch is somebody who performs miracles. And they denied outright that she was anything miraculous about her. They were out to diminish her connection to God. And if she could actually perform miracles while defying the church, this would be a power that they didn't care to recognize. She's like a self-appointed a saint. So the church denied that she committed any miracles and denied that she was a witch. And for the English, this was more or less pettifogging. Kill her under some pretext. So the agreement was they're going to try her as a heretic because that's what she most fundamentally was. And that was her, in their eyes, fundamental sin. Not that she performed some tricks of nature, but that she refused to submit intellectually to the demands of the church. She exercised freedom of the intellect in defiance of authority. So in scene 6, we have therefore the heresy trial with some wonderful formulations of the church's demand for obedience and Joan's assertion of individualism. I love these plays that have one character asserting themselves and making an impassioned statement against the assembled world. And I always, from Antigone on through St. Joan, I can pretty much swallow anything as long as somewhere or other somebody stands up and says, I have a right to express my view and I will not submit to authority. And that's one of the common denominators of most of these plays. Joan in the trial has one moment of doubt when she comes to grasp that they are really going to burn her. She thinks to herself, very understandably, it's just not common sense to submit to this sentence that they want me to recant. I better, because it's ridiculous. I mean, she had an element of common sense throughout, which is very unusual in someone who hears voices from God. But so she exercises her common sense and says, okay, I recant. And they thereupon sentence her to the lesser sentence, which is perpetual jail. At which point she recants her recantation. And she says in typical Shavian fashion, I made a mistake. The only mistake I ever made was I thought I was wrong. And he has to get a wisecrack in at the highest point, you see. So she says, I don't recant anymore. I was right all along. She accepts her martyrdom willingly. And it's carried out right before your eyes. Now, you can imagine in a movie how this would be done today. It would be too horrible to watch. Now, the movie you're going to see is an old movie, and it's done very tastefully and very effectively, primarily by showing you the faces of the spectators. You don't have blood and gore and Sigourney Weaver all over the floor. And it's much more chilling. I saw it with a class, and we were all completely transfixed by this, and yet there's no special effects. There's just no special effects. It's something is burning at the stake. It's probably a sack of potatoes or something. So you get an idea of what movies used to be before they decided that $1 billion replaces intelligence. And then we get to the last, which is the epilogue, the comedy. Now, this really upset the critics at the time that the play came out. They thought it should have ended with Joan's death at the stake. Why was the epilogue necessary? Why not simply the rise and fall of Joan of Arc?
because Shaw held that this was absolutely, this epilogue, indispensable to the play. Why? He said, we have to see the comedy of the ages afterwards trying to justify their actions toward her. In other words, he's in a certain way wants to have his cake and eat it too. He gives us a story which is intrinsically in its action a period piece, but he wants at the same time that it should come across to us as not just a historical injustice. He wants it to come across as a universal theme. This is not merely an act of benighted medievals. He is intent on showing that she would have had the same fate throughout history. In other words, her fate is metaphysical by the nature of what some people call the human predicament. It's not merely historical. And the need of this sort of awkward epilogue is to tack onto an essentially historical piece and say, by the way, this is not just historical. And the way he does it is to take actual historical facts after her death and slant them in such a way that you see she would have had it in any period, whenever she would have been born. And therefore, the meaning goes beyond just the particular grievance of the church. He shows us in the form of a fantasy. You can think of it as a dream, or the movie handles it really well, as I say, as a flashback. He shows us what actually happened in later ages. And from the epilogue, we get the essential truth. So that 25 years later, which is true, the verdict of the church court was renounced and reversed. You know why they had to do that. It's not that they underwent a change of heart about Joan in 25 years, but rather she was the one that had crowned Charles. And if she's a heretic, it occurred to them that that raises a big cloud on the legitimacy of his monarchy. So the only thing to do was retroactively wipe out her conviction for heresy and blame the church for having been corrupt. The church itself did this. One by one in the epilogue, her prosecutors gradually greet her, her persecutors gradually greet her. They're so happy to see her again. And each one tells her from his own perspective why she shouldn't stay alive any longer. And this goes right on through to the fact that hundreds of years later, when it was safe and it didn't cause any trouble, she was made a saint. And there's a modern man comes in and Shaw gets a big charge out of the way he's dressed. Many witty touches, a large comic element, and he has this whole character who has one day off from hell each year because he was nice to Joan at the very end. He's a no good guy, but he did one nice thing. He gave her the homemade cross to hold. And he gives a little story on how nice life is there and how many Frenchmen there are down there, etc. And in the midst of this joviality, the ending turns very weary, very serious. They all desert her. She's left completely alone. And she says, how long, O Lord? How long? And that's the end. Now, what is the main conflict? Well, we've already said that. But just to follow our form of always reading off the main conflict from the plot theme. Joan versus the authorities, religious and temporal, English and French. And that breaks down, since the authorities have to be given some identity, into Joan versus the church. And that, in turn, is the French and the English. So there's Cochon. There's a lot representing the French church because there's all the different facets of the Inquisition, from the more scholarly to the more pure to the horrible pettifoggers that fight of whether it should be 23 or 22 charges. You know, the real the real casuists of the church. But Cochon represents the best of the French church, and Stogumber represents the English church. So that's one level of the conflict. Then there's Joan versus the nobility, and there the main French represents, a lot of them representing lesser nobility and so on, but the main one is Charles himself on the French side, and Warwick, the cynical, villainous English gentleman, is the English counterpart. And then least of all the conflict is Joan versus the army. And Dunois is the only one that's really given much play here. And the army respects Talent, but even here, only up to a point. They're not as corrupt as the nobles or the church, but they're a little afraid too. They don't want to go on to Paris, although Joan makes it clear that that is necessary and possible to accomplish the mission, but they're afraid, and Dunois makes the, Joan says, well, I've done so fabulously with the help of God, why won't you believe that he's going to come and save us when we take Paris? And Dunois makes this famous remark, yeah, you did very well because you had numbers on your side. God is on the side of the big battalions. So in other words, that's the classic line for skepticism of miracles. See, and if that line represents Shaw, then Shaw does not believe in miracles. And this is his way of saying she didn't have any miracles, and they threw her over when she tried to do the really impossible. So I think the essential characters are the ones I mentioned. We're turning now to characters, is that right? Yes. And the essential characters are Joan, plus the Dauphin. He is a weak, cowardly, but not unredeemed guy. And her concrete goal is to persuade him. And then the ones from the church, Cochon and the Inquisitor, has a very big role in the heresy scene. I think I've really covered all these. Warwick, Dunois. Now, I think those characters are really essential. Some of the others, they all throw some light, and he had a definite purpose in each one. The Archbishop of Rheims, for example, was to show that the clergy are becoming worldly and pragmatic. After all, we're in the 1400s already, and this clergyman actually says, if I recall at one point, some words to the effect of the Renaissance is coming, which is a funny thing to say at that time, but if I had started my career a little later, I would have gone for Aristotle instead of Jesus, but it's too late for me. So you have a lot of little characters, but the big and the main and the one that's worth discussing the characterization of is Joan. So let us say something about Joan as characterized by Shaw. Well, she's a genius and a saint in his picture. She's a genius as a moral leader, as one with the ability to inspire men. And of course, historically, the issue was that the French were losing not owing to a deficiency of manpower or weaponry, but because of morale. And she was supposedly, according to Shaw at least, a genius as a military strategist. She allegedly anticipated the military realism of Napoleon. She introduced the not necessarily the full armament of modern war, but the dead seriousness of modern war, as against feudal wars, which were very ritualized very often. They would all line up and they'd wait till the enemy had his weapons ready and his armor ready, and they were ready. It was sort of, it was almost ceremonial, like a courtly gavotte. And when everyone was in place and everything was ready, one gentleman would do the honors by sticking his sword in the gizzard of another gentleman. And it was kind of like a choreographed. And Joan wanted to win, and she was supposedly a forebear of Napoleon in saying, you jump in and you smash them down. So that was her prowess as a military strategist. As to being a saint, she was for Shaw the quintessence of virtue. She was not only honest, she was naively honest. She simply had nothing in her to anticipate or believe in intrigues, bluntly outspoken. She knew clearly what was right and wrong. She was impatient with fools. She, just like Stockman, she expected agreement and appreciation for being right and was shocked when she learned the truth about her fellows. She is also a warrior. One character says she's in love with war and religion. And of course, she was in love with the first in the name of the second, because she heard the word of God, she believes, and that told her to go to war. She dresses as a simple soldier. She likes the masculine life. She has no feminine wiles. She does not wear makeup. She does not wear dresses, etc., etc. And her explanation given in the play is that this is not a Freudian repudiation or penis envy, etc., which is, you know, the Freudians go wild over these plays. She says it's common sense. I'm going to live in the barracks and sleep and eat and ride with these rough men from morning to night. How can I possibly do it if I go around in effect with Evard and Cologne and Helena Rubinstein's stockings? This is just, it's bizarre. I've got to go dressed as a completely plain soldier, which is my occupation. On top of which, she just wasn't interested in love life, romance, or sex. She had a passionate sense of mission, and it just, in her case, according to Shaw, overrode all normal desires. She's really asexual. She's not anti-sexual. She's just not interested in it. She has an obsession, you could say, that takes place of every other human interest. But this is supposed to redound to her virtue, because you are supposed to see her. She is as simple a soul internally as her dress is plain and simple externally. There's nothing hidden or devious in her. She's courageous, iron-willed. She can stand alone against the world without even feeling the heat. So she's a pious, virginal saint, and at the same time, she is shrewd, good-humored, and she enjoys this earth. And the idea of spending her time brooding in a prison is out of the question. If she can't have the fields and the animals and the flowers and roll in the hills, burn her at the stake, she said. So she's a very interesting character. This is not your run-of-the-mill heroine. It's not even a typical romantic heroine. This is typical of nobody but Bernard Shaw. I mean, it was someone who combines, and Jean Seberg brings it off. When you read this play, there's some doubt whether you can believe such a character. But I think Jean Seberg in the movie makes it believable. Now, you'll have to decide that for yourself. She is ignorant of the ways of the world. She doesn't know the institutions and the establishment. And she finds out to her sorrow what it's like. But she is not a complete hillbilly. She's the daughter of a farmer who has some prestige in his local neighborhood. She's in effect a middle-class girl with a modest education. She's not an ignorant field hand, although she's certainly not a princess. And Shaw sums her up as a born boss, And if you're interested, read the preface on pages 21 and 22, where he gives his description of Jones summed up. The good thing about Shaw is he almost always writes tracts about his plays, which are longer than the play, to explain everything. So if you have any doubts, you can read his analysis of it. Now, Joan has some traits that are tremendously appealing to me or to an objectivist, despite the fact that she is obviously, it's ridiculous to say that she's religious because she's a saint, but she does have some traits which are astounding and very impressive. For instance, she, as a classic example of the primacy of existence, despite the fact of feeling that consciousness, God, rules the world and is communicating with her, but it's such a perfect interchange. It takes place on page 108 of the play. She's arguing with the archbishop about something, and he accuses her of pride, which, you know, is the standard ploy of the church to induce guilt, make the person forget reality and so on, and introspect and say, what's the matter with me? And Joan has this wonderful line. She says to the archbishop with real, you know, irritation and fed up, never mind whether it's pride or not. Is it true? Is it common sense? Now, that is what you call really the primacy of existence in action. Her loyalty to truth is so deep that even in the face of the declaration of a mortal sin by the church that she respects, she's annoyed that he's trying to take the subject off of reality and onto something else. That is, in one little line, a tremendous characterizing touch. A great playwright should be able to take dialogue in a couple of sentences. The whole character should leap out at you. And this is one of the lines where the very fact that you can think of it shows already how much Shaw understands and how brilliant he is to be able to put that in to her character and just raise her miles above the typical religious zealot who's doing his duty. It's the stress on common sense and on truth that makes Joan so appealing, not simply her loyalty to God, because, you know, Adolf Hitler claimed to be loyal to God, but he never said in a million years, is it true? Is it common sense? I mean, the ideas would just never enter his non-mind. So she has really self-confidence, the confidence to face and deal with reality. Now, despite the fact that Shaw is always ambivalent about everything, he is not about Joan. This is one of the cases where there is no contradiction or undercutting at all built into her character. She is purely good. She is, just head and shoulders above Desdemona. Shaw, by the way, disliked Shakespeare and was very vocal about it, which is another thing that scandalized the English. And he thought very convincingly that Shakespeare was a real coward, that he was afraid of life, and that he huddled in his Olympian detachment sneering at people who were impassioned simply because he had been defeated by life himself. And that what we need are characters in plays that care about something and stake everything on it, not characters who sit back and say, who knows, and I don't know, and what fools these mortals be, and etc. That's all by the way here. But therefore, he never drew characters like Desdemona, but strong, impassioned characters like Joan. Now the question, the really nice question is, if you had to decide, for instance, for homework, is Joan as strong as, or less strong than, or stronger than Antigone? That would be a nice question, and I would be curious to hear your answer to that on Thursday. I'll give you a clue to my answer. It depends on your fundamental interpretation of Joan. In other words, it really depends, to put it paradoxically, on whether Jonah is a human being or not. By human being, I mean a self-created, self-willed, natural organism, or is she really a puppet of God, a manifestation of supernatural power? Because there are things in the play leading to either conclusion, as typical of Shaw, and to decide on her real essence and therefore your final estimate, whether you're enchanted or bored, whether you believe in the reality of this kind of potential or not, you have to decide on her relationship to the supernatural. And that will take you into Shaw's view of the supernatural. And I can't even find my intermission. I think we better take our break here. Let's cut it to 5 minutes today. Now, we don't have time to go through the other characters, and it's not really necessary. Some are obviously more sympathetic than others. Some are deliberately surprising, like Stogumber. And you notice how he goes through a conversion from being in effect a fiend to a pathetic, guilt-ridden heap. And I think that is, he was basically Shaw's attempt to dramatize what we would call a perceptual level mentality. In other words, as long as Joan was just, her burning was an abstraction, he was all for it. And when he actually confronted the fumes and saw the ashes, he was transfixed. So he's supposed to indicate the level of person who can speak in floating abstractions, but nothing is real to him until it reaches the perceptual level. So there's all these juicy little things on the side in the characterization. But the important thing about all the characters that I want to make before we leave the discussion of characterization is that according to Shaw, there are no villains in this play, Cochon and the Inquisitor emphatically included. Now, I don't have the time to read the paragraph on page 43 of the preface in which he explains his reasons, which are a mixture of very good and very bad. But it's the passage that starts, "There are no villains in the piece." I want to simply give you his motive for insisting on this. He is eager to present the trial of Joan as fair. He wants to have the best, most honest inquisitor imaginable. He wants to insist that her trial was far fairer than what we today take as a fair trial. It's a decision strictly according to their law, and she'd be even worse today. And therefore, he says he wants to head off at the pass people who dismiss what happened as typical medieval rubbish. He wants you to feel very strongly that his theme is universal, that it's relevant today. It's not merely a matter of corrupt personalities. And one commentator says, quote, "The reason Shaw enters so sympathetically into the mentality of the Inquisition is not to exonerate it, but to make his point that the most nefarious institutions always seem perfectly justified in their own eyes and in the eyes of most onlookers." Shaw forces us to look at the trial with the eyes of the 15th century, not because he thinks the Inquisition was right, but because the 15th century regarded its procedures as perfectly respectable and was just as comfortable about them as we are about our own law courts. Now, I can agree entirely with this intention on the part of Shaw, and would be happy to give you a list at random of the institutions and laws that are commonly accepted or praised without a qualm today that later centuries will look at with equal or greater horror than we look at the Inquisition. And I wouldn't even know where to start, and I really think with this audience I don't have to. But just taking it on a purely legal basis, what about the insanity defense in our courts? What about the malpractice situation against the doctors? What about the antitrust laws against businessmen? Or going a little wider, what about the abolition of free speech in the name of political correctness at the universities? Or even such a fantastic depravity as the abolition of public toilets in New York City in the name of egalitarianism because the handicapped have difficulty wheeling into them. Anybody who wants to throw stones at the 15th century on the grounds that they had institutionalized unreason had better first of all realize the glass house he's living in the 20th. The evils that Jones suffers comes, according to Shaw, and of course I agree with him entirely here, not from her time, but from what? Well, Shaw puts it this way. A saint's strongest and most dangerous opposition, here saint means a noble person, comes from the most high-minded and best-intentioned members of society. Unquote. And Ayn Rand had the same idea when she had somebody say, Dominique say to Keating, you're not our worst, Peter, you're our best. That's what makes it so horrifying. Putting it another way, I agree with Shaw that the cause of history is not plain criminals or hypocrites. Shaw believed that the cause of history is what people believe, their ideas. And in that I agree with them. And from that point of view, the really sincere people are the source of evil. Not all who are sincere, but the sincere about the ideas which are fundamentally irrational. The ones who mean their poison are who are the engines of spreading it. They are infinitely more dangerous than the Al Capones or the club women who mouth one thing and do another. John Galt's greatest opposition comes from Jesus or Kant. And in that sense, Shaw is right. It's from the most high-minded, even best-intentioned, in quotes, that is, people who put their cards on the table and say where they stand ideologically and what they're after. That's what moves history. And so he's giving a sympathetic portrait of the Inquisition to show what that they are motivated by certain principles and that the evil comes not from corrupt personalities but from the kind of ideas which in one form or another are still around today. And he knows perfectly well that this is a glamorized portrait of the Inquisition, but it's exactly the reason that Ayn Rand gives a glamorized portrait of Andrei Taganov in We the Living. She knows that there are no communists like him, but she wants to show what does this idea mean, and the best way to show it is to take its most sincere exponent. That gives it a universality other than the accident of personality. Now that brings us directly to Shaw's theme. In this play. Well, the basic clash you can read off from the plot theme, and that's the whole idea of being able to get a plot theme, the genius or the saint as against the entrenched institutions of society. His theme is the superiority of the genius over social authority. But he also has built into his abstract theme a tragic element. Because he believes the destiny of the great individual is to be rejected, even martyred by the collective. As one commentator puts it, the Shavian hero is always an alien in the human realm. So it's an essentially tragic or malevolent universe theme, except in the long, long run, like 500 years later, she won St. Joan. But it really didn't do her a lot of good during her life on earth. The solitude of genius, the shrinking away of the world from greatness, the need of the great individual to stand alone, that's all part of his theme and read or reread page 112 of the play in the edition I recommended. Who does Joan sound like when she says, "I am alone, I have always been alone, my loneliness is my strength"? Obviously, Shaw was tremendously influenced by Ibsen and even wrote a book about Ibsen. And he got this, obviously, from Ibsen. Well, if your theme is that the establishment demands conformity and is threatened by innovation or individualism, then the perfect model of any establishment would be the Inquisition. Because according to them, individualism is the sin of heresy. It's a capital offense. And I want you to notice how Shaw labors to prove that the need of authority, the church's need of authority, is not a random evil and is not even simply a matter of power lust. It is an issue of moral principle to them. And he makes as persuasive a case as he can for this. He's trying to show that he has them say, as a matter of fact, that however innocently disobedience starts, this is Cauchon says this, the Inquisitor says this, that disobedience will necessarily grow and lead in the end to the overthrow of the church. And since the church is by all accounts, and even Jones, the embodiment of the morals and of the civilizing principles itself, the disobedience to the church is a mortal threat to human survival in a civilized fashion. They look on it, you see, exactly as you would look at controls under capitalism. If you had a laissez-faire society and someone said, "Let's put price controls on oil because it's they're charging too much for it," you would immediately say, if you accept that principle, the controls are going to necessarily grow and you're going to end up subverting and destroying the whole system. And you would be right. Well, they look, the church looks, the idealized embodiments of the church presented by Shaw, look at the authority of the church in exactly that way. Either their authority is to be accepted as a matter of principle and there is to be absolute submission, or it will be disaster, subversion of the total system, which is true, because as soon as they started to rebel, the rebellion got completely out of hand, and the church was broken, not only by the Reformation, but by the fact that the rebellion is continuing to this day, and it's just a long, historical, drawn-out collapse. Now, of course, I don't mean I'm on the side of the church, but what Shaw is trying to show is that these churchmen are admirably principled and therefore awful, but that they are much more admirable than their anti-ideological, pragmatic, mealy-mouthed types that, for instance, inhabit the White House today. Now, of course, Shaw himself is 100% opposed to the attempt of the church to extract total submission. And he has Joan give a brilliant answer. The church says to Joan at one point, "Our charge is that you decided on your own without following the church." And then Joan has this terrific line, which is virtually out of Galt's speech, I mean, even in wording. "What other judgment can I judge by but my own?" Now, you can't beat that as a formulation. You want her to use her judgment, but not to judge. They should judge that the church is right, she should, but without judging, because she, who is she to judge? So the very formulation shows the complete bankruptcy of the church and goes along with her primacy of existence. It's her true independence. Now, what, according to Shaw, is the real motivation of the persecutors of the great man? Principle is what they put forth, and to some extent sincerely believe, but underneath it is, in his view, ordinary dullards resent greatness. They hate mental giants. in part Joan or her type as a reproach, and so the ordinary people are jealous, and in part she's a threat. She shows up their pretenses. She's a better soldier than the head of the army. She's got more leadership potential than the king, etc. And consequently, in the epilogue, each in a moment of innocence apologizes and loves her. And then, when she suggests coming back, because being a saint, now she can come back to life whenever she chooses, they all say no. And as Charles put it, if she did come back, we'd burn you again in 6 months, even though we adore you all at this moment. Well, will this tragedy ever end, or is this mankind's destiny for infinity? How long, O Lord? And the answer is in Shaw's broader philosophy. Now, the broader philosophy is not really dramatized in the play, although the tips of the iceberg are all over the play. But to get the iceberg, you have to read his writings. And he says it all in the preface to this play. You can never accuse him of being overly terse. How long will this dichotomy between genius and the masses last? Well, asks Shaw, what is its cause? What are the deeper roots of greatness, such as Jones? And why does it necessarily fly in the face of the establishment? He's not satisfied with just while ordinary people resent greatness. Why? What's the deepest metaphysical reason we could give that there are these geniuses that continuously clash with the establishment? Well, we better start here with noting that there is a real miracle for Shaw, whatever other miracles are in debate. He regards the appearance of an individual like Joan, and not only her, but throughout history, that type, as being a true miracle that can't be accounted for in natural terms. An individual so utterly unique, unswerving, so militant of will, such a genius at surmounting all obstacles. Shaw says flatly that something mystical is necessary to explain this. Not the traditional mysticism, but a new kind of mysticism, which is not that far from the traditional. Now, before we plunge into his full answer, let's take a look here at the miracles in the play, the miracles and the voices, because that is really the key to the philosophy of the play and to your interpretation of the character of Joan. How do you interpret the voices and the miracles? What is Shaw's view of these? Does he believe in revelations and miracles? Does he dismiss them as puerile and scientifically explicable? Or is there still something, a third alternative? Well, let's go through the possibilities. On the one hand, Shaw is an unbeliever. He's a skeptic in regarding religious tradition. He says this in the preface, and Joan even says it in the play, that her voices are the voice of common sense. In effect, she has a vivid imagination. She's a genius in terms of native endowment, and her subconscious instantaneously grasps the correct course in her field of interest, military strategy. Her subconscious just gives her the insight, which is perfectly reasonable given the evidence available, and she simply, having a vivid imagination, projects this outward as voices. But it really has no supernatural or religious significance. Now, there really is a line in the play throughout that develops that theme, and Shaw affirms it in the preface. And along similar lines with regard to miracles, there's a lot to suggest that Shaw does not believe in miracles. First of all, a lot of them are big jokes that he chuckles over, like the hens stop laying eggs and then they start again. And he makes a point of having the cynical archbishop explain in advance the miracle of Joan's recognition of the Dauphin. He has this memorable line from Dunois, which he obviously agrees with, which I've already quoted, that God is on the side of the big battalions and that she won through military naturalistic means and not through miracle. Now, as I say, throughout you can find in Shaw this naturalistic, anti-theological, anti-mystical element, which, of course, if you're inclined that way and you like Joan, you'll be inclined to absorb and accept as his view and the view of the play. And you'll take it as a satire on the pathetic delusions of the religious. On the other hand, however, you should know that Shaw passionately rejects 19th century atheism. You know, the righteous rejection of voices and miracles, the idea that the voices are just hallucinations of a diseased mind, or that miracles are nothing but coincidences or lies spread by the credulous, and that the whole thing is a sham or an aberration, that everything can be explained naturalistically and scientifically. Now, Voltaire wrote a work in which he made fun of Joan of Arc. In the name of reason, he just made her a farcical figure and a prostitute on the grounds that no one who claimed voices purported to perform miracles was worthy of being taken seriously. Now, Shaw was very hostile to Voltaire for this also. So his view is there is something more to the voices than just ordinary vivid imagination. There's some mysterious, opaque aspect to the voices which Joan and Shaw won't discuss, because, as she says in the play, I can't tell you because you won't understand. And going right along with this, side by side with the joking miracles, in the ones that are obviously predictable in advance by natural means, there are utterly unexplained miracles in this play about which there are no jokes and about which Shaw is really serious. Not to mention the one about the wind changing at exactly the right moment, because that could conceivably be coincidence. But you cannot get away from the ultimate symbolic miracle that you cannot burn or drown her heart. Now, this is not discussed, it's not joked about, but it's treated reverentially by the worst skeptics in the play. It obviously is meant to suggest something extraordinary. So, what is it? Shaw holds that the traditional religious interpretation is wrong, but 19th century rationality is wrong too. And he says flat out in his introduction, his preface, that she cannot be explained in purely rational terms. Something mystical is necessary. That's his word. So he does have a real similarity to the religionists. And what is necessary is how to explain the miracle of Joan herself, so utterly different from all of her fellows. Now, I can only give you his answer by giving it. This is why he is not put in the history of philosophy as a major thinker. There are, he says, forces that work in the universe, mystical forces, using individuals for cosmic purposes. There is an appetite at the core of the universe. And if you were a German philosopher in the 19th century and you believe that there's an appetite, a craving, a striving at the core of reality, and you wanted to use a nice word with the capital W, you would call it the will. And these people were called voluntarists, and Shaw is one of them. Now, suppose we throw in that this will develops by going through a process with a letter E of evolution. And we come out with the idea that reality is a cosmic will to evolve. A will that evolves. Now, this is obviously voluntarism of Schopenhauer and especially of Nietzsche, because the will takes the form of periodic supermen. Now, when he says evolution, it is not a Darwinian evolution. We're way outside the realm of biology, or what he regards Darwin as far too mechanical and, you know, ordinary science. This is evolution with a purpose of its own. It's a Hegelian type of evolution. And there's a will that wants to live out its own career, create itself, discover itself, fulfill itself. And in the process of its evolution, it continuously creates whatever it needs to reach the next stage. So if it needs hands and it doesn't have any, it grows hands. And suddenly there's something with hands. If it needs a brain, etc., etc. This is an evolution which is creative in the sense that it creates the means of its own further development, in effect out of thin air as it goes along. And he calls this his theory of creative evolution. From his point of view, therefore, this was his philosophy. That's all I can say. Joan was a expression of God, God being the more conventional name for this gigantic evolutionary will. She is a manifestation of will. She's a step in God's self-development. This appetite for evolution periodically takes shape, as Nietzsche had said, in supermen, in visionaries, in geniuses, in saints, which pull the race forward and thus pull itself forward, because the whole race is, as Hegel said, just this inner cosmic force itself objectified out into a group of people. So people like Joan for Shaw are not lunatics or misguided the way Voltaire thought, nor are they natural, mundane, scientifically explicable. They are tools of the superpersonal, and indeed of the supernatural, because the will is certainly not natural. They're tools of the impersonal life force. And that, you see, is pretty close to being agents of the traditional God. In effect, they're agents of God, except Shaw's God is not perfect and motionless like Aristotle's or like the Christian God. He's imperfect and growing and evolving. And this is sometimes called atheistic mysticism. But it's a lot closer to religion than the word atheism suggests. So I think it's much better to call it, as Ayn Rand does, neo-mysticism. It's all the essentials of traditional mysticism, but given a fancy and pseudo-modern cast. And within the framework of the religion of creative evolution, St. Joan is the hagiography. You know what that is? The writing about the saints. And consequently, there will be an eternal clash between the genius and the crowd, because the genius is the will moving to the next stage and having to pull the crowd up the evolutionary development. What it really amounts to is Platonism over again. There's a clash between those who are in touch with God, the few higher, the elite, and the mass of men, and those in touch have to just drag the rest of the world to destiny. Now, if you see Joan within the framework of this philosophy, well, I'm afraid that that will have a tremendous impact on your feeling for her as a character. Now, Shaw insists that she has free will. He's rabidly opposed to determinism, to mechanism, to materialism. She is not, he says over and over, a puppet. But the question is, how can she possibly have free will or self-responsibility or self-determination if she is a fragment of a cosmic will pursuing its destiny and simply manifesting itself momentarily and temporarily as her? Isn't she then nothing else but a shadow or puppet expressing the deeper forces calling the tune? So if you take seriously the mystic element, I think Joan loses all credibility and therefore everything that makes you admire her. And the play collapses. You have to struggle to keep her a volitional, strong, self-sustaining human being. And to do that, you have to overlook not only the creative evolution theory, which thankfully is not in the play, but all of the slant toward mysticism which is in the play and which are the tip of the iceberg of his basic philosophy. If Shaw presented his mysticism and his view of miracles and voices too clearly in the play, you would just say she's a cardboard figure, she has no reality. If he doesn't present it at all, though, he doesn't get across what he wants to. And he leaves utterly baffling why there's going to be an eternal dichotomy. So Shaw is in the position that he has to suggest and withdraw the suggestion. He has to get you to think there are miracles and voices at work, and isn't that ridiculous? And the combination sort of allays your critical faculties and enlists your heart on her side. But it's really a sleight of hand here. He is drawing her strength from her individualism while repeatedly hinting murkily that there are forces beyond her control moving and determining her, and he really never connects the two. And this is typical of Shaw. He is not a systematic thinker, and he wants his cake and have it too. Now, as you of course know, when you compromise on fundamentals or you try to have your cake and eat it too, you ultimately have to capitulate to the worst element. And therefore, you shouldn't be at all surprised that despite his intellectual brilliance and his extreme intellectuality, he's generally classed as a philosopher of irrationalism, and correctly so classed. Who preaches feeling above reason. As one commentator puts it, Shaw favored the psychology of the romanticists. Now here they're using romanticists in the sense of Fichte, Schelling, Schopenhauer, the real German irrationalists of the 19th century, which was akin to that of many earlier thinkers such as Pascal, you know, the real French mystic. From an earlier period, the heart has its reasons which the reason does not know. That's Pascal. Shaw asserted that man is primarily a feeling, not a thinking animal. He insisted that the driving force of human existence is an irrational will about which we can do nothing. And here's a direct quote from Shaw, which is pretty much brings this point to a close. Life is not the fulfillment of a moral law or of the deductions of reason, but the satisfaction of a passion in us of which we can give no account whatsoever. Unquote. So I'm afraid you have to conclude that Joan's heroism is essentially mystical and irrationalist. And that's why I don't vote for her, aside from her outfits, which I don't find sexually attractive, but I don't vote for her as one of the strongest ones. Shaw, you see, is a really interesting, unusual, but not too coherent case. If you look at this play and try to sum up superficially, you could make a good case that he's for reason. He comes out for thought in the face of the Inquisition. He's strongly for egoism. He likes Joan's pride and self-assertion. And he has her say, my only mistake was that I mistrusted myself. He's for individualism as against the collective or obedience to the authorities. So on the face of it, this is reason, selfishness, individualism. He is a soulmate of objectivism. But the opposites of all of these ideas are much stronger and much purer in him. The neo-mysticism and the altruism. Because remember, the whole motive of this struggle is not for Jones' own happiness or fulfillment. It is what he calls heroic altruism. In other words, she's a tool of the higher power, and she is destined to suffer, abnegate herself, and die the way Jesus did on the cross for the ultimate goal, which is the complete fulfillment and moral development of the human collective. And that will be, in Shaw's opinion, when God has finally reached the end of the creative evolutionary process. So he is a thorough altruist, and you understand now why, despite being an arch individualist, he was a total crusading socialist, he was an egalitarian, he was even a totalitarian, because you see, his Platonic idea, his contempt for the masses and the idea that the few super individuals who have insight into the mystical truth, he was an admirer of Stalin and even Hitler. So you have to be really careful when you say somebody's an individualist. A lot more is required than merely to say, I uphold the right of the individual to think. Remember back to Schiller. As Schiller upheld that, but he is, and Schiller, on a scale of 1 to 10, is 9 in individualism relative to Shaw being maybe 3. I think you now get an idea what ambivalence means, not to say outright self-contradiction. That I would summarize it by saying he was a great playwright, but a terrible philosopher. Now I'm going to take one moment, instead of pretending that this is asked as a question, to throw in a comment on his stylistic approach in conclusion. But consider that the question period started here, so you won't say it was too short a question period. The stylistic attribute that is a combination that is unique to Shaw is the combination of deadly serious intellectuality plus raucous comedy. It's that distinctive union. On the one hand, he's serious about ideas. He's deep. He grants ideas an important role in history. He thinks they have to be taken seriously. He has, in that sense, a philosophic view of history and criticizes Shakespeare for not appreciating the importance of ideas as motivating factors. He says everybody in Shakespeare acts as they do because they're angry or they're jealous or they're ambitious, and you never get an idea. What is their view of the universe? What do they think? And yet that's really what moves history. So, and you see that in this play. St. Joan has its share of intellectual, very serious, and even very deadly moments when she says, I'm the child of God and you are not fit that I should live among you. There's no witty edge to that. But at the same time, there is this comedic element pervasive in all of his plays, a sly, bantering element, wit, wisecracks, farce, satire, caricature, all the way through and with not even stopping for a minute during the tragedy. Now, this is a unique form of what you could call tragic comedy. But Corneille, at the beginning of the tragic comic idea, meant serious issues, heroes of stature, and happy endings. This is serious issues, heroic stature, tragic endings, and a laugh a minute from beginning to end. Now, this would be just simply inconceivable to earlier centuries. They just would have thrown their hands up. And I may say there's still a lot of people who throw their hands up because they're completely put off. But in a way, it seems to me so perfect because it's the counterpart stylistically of Shaw. He'd give every idea a hearing and every stylistic approach a hearing. It's like he wanted to be everything, and he couldn't commit himself to the limitations of an identity. But the tragic part is that he did everything so brilliantly And his wit has a great humor, a great value. It's on stage, if it's done by a British company, you know, that can deliver lines like this and do something other than grunt, it's really enjoyable. You just laugh and laugh, and you're just completely satisfied, and you kind of lose sight of the fact that you're not entirely sure what the play is about, and where is it going, and what does it mean, but it's really entertaining stuff. But the question is, in a total and mature assessment, what do you do with the clown in Shaw? Now, I'm going to leave you today without an answer, but I've suggested to you that I'm ambivalent about it because I enjoy that element in him, but I don't really think it ultimately sits well with the tragic element, not in the form he does it. But here's a quote from Shaw himself talking about the continual eruption of funny business in his plays. Quote, he says, "This has prevented me from becoming a really great author. I have, unfortunately, this desperate temptation that suddenly comes on me. Just when I am really rising to the height of my power that I may become really tragic and great, some absurd joke occurs and the anticlimax is irresistible. I cannot deny that I have the tragedian and I have got the clown in me, and the clown trips me up in the most dreadful way." So, you know, whether he's serious or not, or whether he was serious that day and changed his mind tomorrow, the deeper question is this a liability or an asset, an extra dimension of greatness or an undercutting of his greatness? I'll leave you to think about that. I'll just tell you that in my modest way, without any pretensions that I'm the equivalent of Shaw, I tried to write a serious fiction scene at one point within the last couple of years, and the theme was, the story that I was telling at that point was that the young hero learned that he had a fatal disease and was going to die. That was my sole assignment. It was like an exercise for a class. But it was part of a novel which at that time no longer I was thinking of doing. And I wrote this with what I thought was, you know, heartstrings and, you know, as complete serious and the shock, etc. And in accordance with the rules of the class, there was about, I don't know, 20 or 30 of us. You had to Xerox copies. Everyone got to read it in advance, and then it was a workshop. They would come back with their comments. I just about fell through the floor when I got the comment. The consensus of the class was this was the funniest thing they ever read. And I just gasped. I didn't even know whether they had read the same thing I wrote. And I got all this praise for being so clever and so witty. It's just hysterical. And here I wrote a scene about the death, you know, and how this guy is going to die. And I just was baffled. I went home and reread it a couple of times. And then as though from a distance, I thought, well, you could take that as sarcasm, I guess, although I wasn't conscious of it. And anyway, to make a long story short, within about a month, I thought the thing was funny. So I can, not, as I say, not to presume to compare myself, but I can understand having this acerbic element that just has to come out and that comes out whether you know it or not. And I think that's one of the reasons that I like Shaw so much, is that I identify entirely the fact that he's serious and he can't resist bitter wisecracks, which I go for that combination, even though intellectually I don't think that it's the highest possible form. I stopped writing fiction when I found that out. Thank you very much. Okay.
Okay, the wider issue, a lot of objectivists discuss this. I think this thing about combining humor with seriousness and when humor is appropriate and things like that. And so I just had a thought. I wonder whether part of the issue would be in Shaw and in the general issue of when one combines humor with serious events and things like that, whether part of the issue might be whether it's a negative or the absence of a positive. In other words, if in a play, for example, his humor gets in the way of something that could be an intensely dramatic moment, something of that nature.
I think there is something to what you say, but that's not a full exoneration. You want to laugh at the negative, not at the positive. That's certainly true. You satirize or you laugh at the fools, because the laughing means don't take it seriously. Laughter, as Ayn Rand used to say, is a denial of reality. When humor is a way of making something unreal, of saying, I refuse to take this as part of reality. So it is a weapon of negation. And it's therefore, it's very appropriate if you're against the world. One of the ways of retaining your sanity is to use, and I do that, use humor to cut down the things that you are opposed to. It's a way of continually reaffirming what you believe in. Whereas if you use humor at the expense of what you regard as the good, then you are using it as a weapon of denying the reality of the good. That's why, for instance, Ayn Rand was very witty, but she would never laugh at a hero slipping on a banana peel. Because the idea of that is to make the hero, to make his heroism unreal. Now, Shaw sometimes uses humor. He'll laugh indiscriminately at everything, including at his positive characters. And when he does that, I have no hesitation in saying that this is a bad use of humor. But he does not laugh at Joan. He is very reverential about her, which is one of the reasons I chose this play. It's very uncharacteristic of him that it is he withheld his humor from her. So it's not the problem that you say. It's still the case emotionally. And the best example is at the very moment when your heart is in your mouth as to what's going to happen to her, there'll be a wisecrack about the French versus the British. I mean, it descends. There'll be a little tinge of sarcasm, and I think it's what he said, that he can't keep it out of him. It's irrepressible, and he was too powerful for any editor to take it out. And the result is, as someone pointed out, it has the effect of muting the impact of his plays. It's as though he couldn't face the full reality of how awful it is that this was happening to Joan. And the way to stop it is to make a joke, not at her expense, but just in conjunction with the event. And therefore, the idea is we don't have to take anything too seriously and nothing is that desperate. You see what I mean? Whereas, that in effect he was repressed. That is the accusation. That humor was, to him, was a means of keeping tragedy at a distance. And now, if that's true, that is a very bad literary trait in a tragedian. If he's writing comedy, that's one thing. If he's writing witty satire, that's one thing. But what stops me is that here he's got humor in the heart of the tragic moment. And that, I think, is undercutting. Now, I'd like you to watch the movie tonight from that point of view, because Graham Greene did not keep Shaw's, the degree of his raucousness, but it's obviously Shaw. So you decide for yourself what effect it has. Yes.
You see the idea?
I'm going to go on for a few minutes yet, but if your car is in jeopardy, go on, rescue.
We see the idea of evolution being common to Ibsen and Shaw. I was wondering if that's common to other playwrights of the period. So I didn't see it in Cyrano, for example, which I believe was of the same period.
No. Well, Cyrano is a little later.
Okay.
The question was, is the idea of evolution common to playwrights other than Ibsen or Shaw? Yes, as far as I know, any playwrights in the 19th century who had a pretension to philosophy or intellectual seriousness made their obeisance to evolution. Maeterlinck certainly did for Mona Vana. It was just taken for granted. It was in the atmosphere. That does not mean that it has to come up in every play. or that necessarily every play, however great, had that as somewhere at its base, but it was much more widespread than Ibsen and Shaw. Yes.
Yeah. My question is, could the tragic comedy aspects of Ibsen and Shaw be due to the what I call the neo-absolutism of both of them, like their evolutionary aspects? Like,
well, how would that relate to it?
Well, you know, like if you're an absolutist like Rand, you would take ideas totally seriously. But if you believe that you know, you evolve, you get to a point, then it changes, then you would say, well, you know, you got it here.
Well,
but then,
you're saying that his humor frees him from the need to commit to intellectual absolutism.
Well, no, it's an expression of his neo-absolutism.
Oh, it's an expression of the fact that he's not committed to absolute.
Right, that he's committed and not committed at the same time.
Well, first of all, I balk at Ibsen being included, because Ibsen, despite his few relativist statements, was an absolutist. He was an utter extremist. But now in the case of Shaw, you might have a better case there, that he does not want to commit to an absolute, and the laughter has the effect of softening any commitment intellectually that he makes. The whole thing with laughter is that it has the effect of undercutting, because that's what laughter is. It's a weapon of unreality, of creating unreality. I think you're entirely right. If Shaw were completely convinced of one ideology, one unequivocal, unambivalent ideology, he could not write this way. I tried to indicate that, but you're doing it even more clearly. It's precisely because he's got a foot in a whole bunch of different camps, and he doesn't want to have to stand all in one camp, that he'll laugh at the religious people, and then he'll laugh at the cynics. You know, and it's like universal putting down. And at the same time, he wants to have hero worship. So he wants everything. And I think laughter is an expression of that, and gives him a means of achieving it. But I think that usage is a problem, because then the problem is that he never commits to anything, and therefore everything is up in the air, and even the laughter stops becoming funny. However, I don't accept your view that is inherent in the combination, because, well, just speaking my own private taste, I've always liked those British wits like Oscar Wilde, for instance, or Noel Coward, who deal with serious issues in a witty way, with an edge, who can come up with, you know, immortal epigrams. It's a typically British or English trait. Of course, they don't write tragedies. Or if they did, like Salome, they don't make jokes about it. But I like the humorous element in The Fountainhead. There's a lot of bitterness in The Fountainhead, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Not in its essential theme and characterization, but in little touches, which I just treasured when I was growing up. Just little things like, you know, Ralston Holcomb, his hair went up in a great sweep. It left dandruff on the back of his neck. Now, you know, she's full of those coruscating remarks. So the people who say that she has no sense of humor, I don't even know in what dimension they live. But the thing is, she's very clear that she's impassioned about what the good is or what the true is. And she makes fun only of the bad or the lesser. And if you could retain it in that combination, then I think humor is a terrific adjunct. I use humor as a deliberate device of lecturing. And I stumbled on it because I found when I first started lecturing that classes got bored. And they got bored no matter how interesting I thought the presentation was. And I discovered that modern audiences simply have an antipathy to ideas from the way they're brought up, that it's going to be boring and deadly and irrelevant, and that takes over no matter how interesting they find the idea. And therefore, what you have to do is periodically rescue them from the demon of a serious ideas. And I would just inject a little crack, you know, a little wisecrack, and then the audience would laugh, and then for a moment, you would feel like you bought yourself 3 minutes of time now, because, you know, it's not as horrifying as they thought. They sort of smile, and then about 5 minutes later, they drift back, and the thought strikes them subconsciously, oh, it's some more of this serious stuff, so you give one more. And I built that into it as a style. Now, that was deliberately a pedagogical device, but obviously it had to grow out of an interest in humor itself on my part. Anyway, I don't want to go further. Is any more about the play now? Yes, at the back.
Was the movie version done after Shaw's death?
I don't think it was done after his death because he outlived just about everything. I think it was done in the 40s.
Do you know how he reacted to it at all? How he reacted, especially
to the way he approved it. Graham Greene is a very prestigious writer. I believe Shaw was consulted, and it was considered a great honor to have Graham Greene. You know, he's the one that did The Heart of the Matter and The End of the Affair and all kinds of famous novels. So I think he liked the movie, from what I know. Pardon? It was 59? Oh, I didn't know that. Well, what year did he die? He died in 50? Well, then that refutes me out of my mouth. Then maybe I'm thinking of the estate of Shaw. I vaguely remember that someone connected with Shaw approved the movie. Or maybe I have megalomania and I'm just thinking that I approved the movie. All right, I'll take one more question. Is there any other last questions? Okay, then, we'll make Mona Vana on Thursday. Thank you.